Here we are again, Natalie.
We're back.
Doing our second one.
Wow, we've got our second episode. We have so many fun things in store.
Like what? What are we doing?
Well, let's see. Last week we went to Retrofret and we had a conversation with a very interesting man who we will introduce a little bit later. And I think we're going to listen to some songs.
Yeah, we're going to play songs off of Jalopy Records because we have more than 40 records now. Crazy. So we thought we'd just play songs off of Jalopy Records.
And we picked some really good ones. And then I think we have a live performance later on.
Yes. I recorded it just today with Wyndham Baird. He's going to... I think we've decided today that we're just sticking to Woody Guthrie songs.
Oh, I love this.
So he'll just do Woody Guthrie songs. Because, of course, right. We have to get permission. And we know Woody Guthrie's daughter and her son. So I don't think we're going to have any trouble getting permission.
Amazing. That also just feels right.
Yeah.
Where would we all be without Woody Guthrie?
Exactly. Where would, folk music be without Woody Guthrie? Jeez.
Man.
Well, I think we should get going. You ready?
I'm ready.
Excellent. Here we go.
It's the Jalopy Corn Dog Hour with your hosts, Natalie Jordan and Jeff Wood. Recorded right here at the fabulous Jalopy Theater and School of Music in Red Hook, Brooklyn. So, without further ado, here we go!
In that bright land where my love
We all just heard Lone Prairie by the Downhill Strugglers.
Great friends of ours.
Great friends of ours. Great musicians. A beautiful album.
Who's in that band?
Well, we've got Walker Shepherd and Eli Smith and Jackson Lynch. And we had Jackson on the first episode of the show, so it feels right to have him kind of on the second one, too.
Absolutely.
And that song is it's a cowboy folk song. So beautiful. There are so many incredible versions of it, but I think, if I may say, that the Strugglers have the number one spot.
Excellent.
And Eli Smith plays banjo in that band most often. I think sometimes mandolin and will sing as
and
well.
And guitar, too.
And guitar, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all kind of switch sometimes.
Yeah, they just hand them around.
Yeah. Man, they're so good.
Yeah.
Eli actually came with us to Retrofret last week when we spoke with Peter.
Yes, we went and talked to Mr. Peter Coleman, working there at, he's sort of a partner there, really built the place out. We're going to hear all that from him, though, of course, because he really gives us a lot of information on him and Retrofret. And, you know, when I first started thinking about making this podcast, I was thinking about music history and things about Jalopy. And he was one of the first people that came to mind. Like, oh, we should go talk to Peter. Because he's funny and he's so unbelievably knowledgeable about
incredible
instruments. Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming. And he knows it. He likes that.
Yeah, I'm sure he could have talked to us for hours if we didn't have to go home.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And we'll go back and interview him some more.
Yeah.
I think we'll get more specific things about specific instruments and, you know, instrument companies, and it'll be good. Okay, so without further ado, here's Peter Coleman. So, we're here with Peter.
Freeform jazz, verbally and vocally. And I'm leaning right into the microphone to get the most mellifluous tone.
Excellent. Hello. So good. So good. Please introduce yourself.
All right. My name's Peter Coleman, or Peter Stewart Coleman. I use my middle name because my last name was so confusing to teachers that I've seen epic misspellings. So I used to actually play as Peter Stewart, but then a guy came up with that name who got more famous than me. So now I use all three just to confuse everyone as much as possible.
Why? What's so confusing about Coleman?
Because it's not Cohen or Coleman or Coleman or any of the amazing variety of misspellings and mispronunciations that my youth engendered. So, and when I thought I was going to be a young teenage rock star, my best friend was named Andrew Cohen. And we thought that Cohen Coleman, or Coleman Cohen, if it had been me, was the worst songwriting credit ever. So his middle name was Lindsay, and mine was Stewart. And we thought, ooh, Lindsay Stewart, that sounds English. We sound like an English pop band. That'll be perfect. And, of course, we never had the band never took off, and we ended up hating each other, and there you go. But Peter Stewart lived on for many years until a guy came out with a band called Dog's Eye View and got signed to Columbia under that name. Huh. And he got more famous than me, and so my solo career imploded in a nomenclature disaster. And ever since then, here I am. But now that I'm no longer an active musician, nobody cares.
Well, there you go.
Now I just write about guitars.
I didn't know you wrote about guitars. I've never seen any of them.
I've
heard you talk about guitars.
It's much easier to talk because you don't have to move your fingers so much.
Yeah.
And if, like me, a keyboard is a terrifying thing, that's why I like doing this, because I'd much rather talk about them than write about them. But I was a feature columnist for Vintage Guitar Magazine for 15 years. And somehow I hacked out a column every month. And a few years ago, right, when the pandemic was coming in, you know, their magazine basically sells to old people. And I think their audience is kind of dwindling. And they did that thing where I got bumped upstairs. They said, well, you're not a columnist anymore. Now you're a feature writer, which means that they only publish it when they feel like it. So suddenly doing a piece a month seemed like a complete waste of time because they're only putting three or four of them out a year. So I'm technically still writing for them, but I'm not doing a monthly column. And I don't know how I ever did that. It's having to do your homework. You know, you remember that? Remember the terror, the eighth grade terror of, oh my God, I didn't do my book report. Well, every month I had a book report to do, but at least I was writing about stuff that I liked and it was actually fun. But you know, I haven't ever put a book together, but I have enough stuff that if I wanted to, I could. And all my friends who've done it have like, oh, it's a great way to lose a whole lot of money. Yeah, put a book together. There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Publish it yourself. Lose all the money. Yeah. So, but it still might happen someday.
And we are sitting here in the nicest vintage guitar and instrument store that I have ever been in. I think it's probably the nicest one ever in Retrofret.
Well, thank you.
And
Retrofret Vintage Guitars, Brooklyn, New York. Look it up on the internets.
How long have you been here?
Doing
Retrofret?
Well, the story of Retrofret is basically a story of the gentleman who owns the whole establishment. His name's Steve Urich, and he's been a luthier since the 70s. And he had been managing another fairly well-known guitar store in New York, and basically had kind of, as many people do, had it with working for someone else who, you know, got all the glory and most of the money, and decided to start his own business kind of when the internet was just taking off, with the idea being that maybe you could actually sell guitars over the internet. And it was sort of when G-Bass was a new thing. It's years before Reverb. And so he started kind of in a very small way putting some guitars together to try to put together a website. And in the meantime, I'd run my own little guitar store in the East Village in the 80s for a few years, which was called Mojo Guitars. And I don't mention that much because the gentleman who I started, ended up having some fairly dubious business practices that I caught wind of early on. So I extracted myself before that tarnished my reputation much. But I did found that store with him. So I'd had some experience in retail. But I've been working a really boring and annoying job in digital printing, because I also was trained as an artist. And after 9/11, that job evaporated, because a lot of the people we were printing for just stopped printing anything. And email showed up, so you didn't have to print things anymore. You could just send a message. Right. So that when that job evaporated, I went, well, what do I like to do? I like to look at guitars. I like to buy guitars. I like to sell guitars. So I started angling to get myself back in the guitar business. And I talked to a few people. And through a crazy connection, there's a gentleman very well known in Brooklyn named Bob Jones, who's the dean of Brooklyn Luthiers.
Yeah.
And for many, many years, if you had a good guitar in Brooklyn or even in Manhattan, Bob was the guy you would bring it to fix it. And through an incredibly weird set of happenstances, I was out of a job, so I was selling instruments on eBay, which was a fairly new thing at the time. And I sold a beautiful Ludwig tenor banjo to a young lady who happened to live in New York, and she came by to collect it and, noticed that there was an open seam on the back of the neck. And I said, well, if you don't want to take, no, I want it, but who should I have fix it? And I suggested Bob Jones. So she took it to Bob, and Bob said, oh, this head is really beautiful. Who did the head? And she said, oh, this guy who I bought it from told me he put the head on. And it turned out that Steve Urich had been asking Bob Jones to rehead some banjos for him, and Bob really hates heading banjos, as most people do.
Oh, I know I do.
So, yeah, so he recommended me to Steve to head banjos. So I had known Steve. Steve had done, we had subcontracted repairs to him from my old shop. If we needed a neck set or something that was beyond our capability, we'd have Steve do it. So I knew Steve. I'd known him since the early 80s through the whole New York. There used to be these crazy New York guitar shows at the beautiful Polyester Ballroom on, I believe it was 10th Avenue and 49th Street. And so I knew, I kind of knew the crew that he had run with at that point. A gentleman named Bob Guida, who anyone who met him thinks is the most beautiful human being you ever met. And we all miss dearly.
Truly.
But Bob was
sort
of
the... We have a big painting on the wall at Jalopy.
Yeah, I have a picture of him in my office smiling down at me every day to remind me not to take anything too seriously.
Oh, man.
And still to take it seriously enough that you care. So I think that's his message to me. But anyway, so somehow through all this, I ended up at Steve's door in Brooklyn saying, I hear you need someone to head banjos. So he hired me at some sort of day rate to come in like once a month and put skinheads on a few banjos. It also turned out he was starting this business and kind of needed someone who was a vintage guitar expert who knew how to write and had Photoshop skills, which guess what? If I'd had a resume, that would have been my resume.
Yeah.
And that was just about 20 years ago. That was in the summer of 2003. And I started showing up one day a week and then 2 days a week and then 3 days a week. And eventually we ended up kind of putting this business together. And there's another gentleman who works here, really is a gentleman, not like me, named George Aslander, who does all our photos, and he's the other long-term Retrofit employee, and he's the one who can really play the guitar. He does beautiful pictures for us, but if you ever hear George play, George can really play the guitar. Not like me, I'm a banger. it's taken me around the world, but I'm still a banger. But anyway, so we started, kind of small, and
yeah, that was really, I met you very soon after that.
Pretty soon after that, yeah. The old store was this really beautiful place.
Oh, that was a beautiful place.
Weird as hell. It was this giant industrial building in the Gowanus, right? The Gowanus Canal literally ended at our front door, but it was the original Brooklyn ASPCA, purpose built as such. And Steve and a gentleman named Larry Trupiano had bought the building in the 80s when it was completely decrepit. Literally, I'm not making this up, with the remains of dead dogs lying around in the yard and cages, and the floor was all pissed on and everything. And they, over 20 years, had, really cleaned it up and made it lovely. Larry had a business repairing pipe organs, which is it's amazing to a lot of people that business exists, but there are churches, there are people who go to sing and worship there, and they need the pipe organ to work, so there's business for that.
And they go and clean them too, didn't they?
Yeah.
Clean the pipes.
Yeah, we have to clean the pipes eventually because they get full of dust.
Yeah.
And they get out of tune, apparently. And all sorts of things. But the organs now are kind of electronic mechanical monsters, so they have lots of stuff to go wrong. They have computer chips to go wrong, and they have mechanical things to go wrong.
Great.
So there's,
make it more complicated.
Yeah, so if you have a church and you have an organ, you need someone to fix it. So that was the primary business out of that building, and Steve was starting. He'd been doing a guitar repair, luthery business for years, but he was getting into the guitar retail idea. So our initial idea was just to be, an internet-only store. But of course, we're dealing in guitars. People like to play them. So people, can I come by and try it out? Like, sure! And we ended up having a showroom by accident. And the original showroom was Steve's living room. And we had a couple of couches and we had some guitars in it. Gradually he got forced out of, where he'd been living. And we end up with a guitar store.
It was up on the roof.
It was up on the roof. He had to go.
So cool. He had to walk out onto the roof on that long walkway. And
it was G.E. Smith came up once and he went, "This is like a speakeasy for guitars." And we thought that was the most apt comment ever. That was pretty much it. I don't know if you remember, we used to have a fellow who worked there named Mike, and Mike was a real, real native Brooklyner, and the human embodiment of Yosemite Sam.
Yes, and, I remember Mike, yes.
And, he was a lot of fun to work with, an enormous pain in the ass, but, in his own way, a really colorful, fabulous human being. But he would answer the bell, "What do you want?" that's welcome to Retrofret. "What do you want?"
I remember first going there, and it said Retrofret so small.
Yeah.
And you're like, "What, this place?"
Yeah. We sort of wanted to stay discreet. Because, even in the early 2000s, it wasn't the greatest neighborhood in the world. And, people could come down and burrow through the roof and steal all the guitars and things. So we kind of wanted to keep it. Originally, the idea was it wouldn't really be a public space. It was just going to be kind of a warehouse where we kept the stuff and we would sell it. But, when you're dealing with old instruments, people have a real personal relationship a lot of the time. So when people started coming in, we realized we actually had a lovely showroom in this kind of hole in the wall that we'd started. We had to leave there because the other partners in the building decided it was time, it was a real estate boom, time to sell the building.
Yeah.
Luckily, we owned enough of it that we were able to buy our own building with the proceeds. So that's where we're sitting right now. And, really, I really love the old shop and I miss it. This one's much better laid out and it's much more efficient. And you can just see we've been able to do so much more. We have 10 times the inventory here that we ever had there.
It's shocking how much is in here.
Yeah, we're full to the brim of guitars right now. They're all staring at me. They're like the puppies looking for a home. It's like the cages are full. And they're all barking at us. But, we try to have, not to get into, shameless promotion, we really try to only have things we like, and that's really hard to do.
I love that idea.
Well, in this business, as you probably have encountered in some ways, that's really hard to do. If you become a dealer for any of the major manufacturers, say I want to be a Gibson dealer. Well, then you have to take all the crap that they want you to sell, the high price stuff, the low price crap. You have to do what they want you to do, and it's all on certain terms, and you end up being in debt to your suppliers endlessly. And, Steve had been through that before, and I've watched it, and neither of us wanted to do that. We want to have a store where every piece in here has been picked by hand. Like, that's here because we like it, or at least because we think it's cool or okay. You know, yeah. They can't all be gems, but we try to make them shine as much as possible. You know, and that's sort of the whole philosophy of the place is there's nothing in here that we can't stand behind. I turn away pieces all the time, some of them with a tear in my eye, but they just can't be fixed to the level that I could really recommend them to a customer. You know, I just had actually fairly well-known luthier contact me today with a guitar he wants to sell, and it's a Gibson Heritage from the late 60s, which is a decent guitar. It's a Rosewood Gibson, so that's kind of cool. But the binding is all rotting out on the top. Yeah. And I'm not going to sell it to a customer that way, because I know in about 5 years it'll just be crumbling off, and they'll come back going, I need you to rebind this. And it's just an enormous pain to do that. And we just we don't have the time. I can't pay someone enough to do it well that I can charge, especially if it's a guitar I sold and I have to, cover it. Well, I can't do it. So I just told him, I can't handle the guitar. So we turn around. I love Gretsches myself. I'm a Gretsch guy. I've been playing Gretsches my whole life. I turn around, I turn away about 7 out of 10 now because of the issues with the plastic and the binding.
Yeah,
the
nitrocellulose
plastic. That's a whole other story. But most 20th century guitars, in the 19th century, they used real ivory. And actually, during World War I, when German East Africa was blockaded, ivory wasn't getting out, so there's no ivory to be had. So even Martin, the highest-end guitar maker and the highest-end banjo maker, switched to using celluloid, ivoroid plastic, which the cheaper people have been using since the 1880s. And, it looked just as good, and it didn't require killing elephants, and it was easier to work with because it's much easier to bend. So yeah. It seemed like a great idea, but unfortunately, celluloid plastic is often unstable over time. So a lot of older instruments now are suffering various problems from it disintegrating. It's a long catalog of guitars in here that have had to have things repaired or replaced because of celluloid disintegration.
Yeah.
Which is kind of sad because we like to keep things original, but as much as possible, we'll replace it with the correct material. Sometimes it's just not possible. You can't get anything that looks like old binding in some senses sometimes.
Yeah, because it's discolored in an interesting way and shows its life, and now it's got this bright.
Yeah, you have to sort of fake it. You have to sort of paint it to make it look old. We'll do it if we have to. There's some beautiful instruments on the wall that we can't let die just because their plastic is trying to kill them. But, I just was just talking to a guy today. I have a guitar from 1940. It's a Gibson ES-300 is the model, which means, for those studying, electric Spanish, $300 with the amp. And the pickup is encased in tortoise celluloid plastic. So, of course, all these original pickups are just destroyed because they're made of wire the thickness of a human hair. So the gas that emits from the decaying plastic destroys the pickup completely. So if it started to go, it's dead. There's no way to save it. There's lots of little weird examples like that. But we see this a lot more.
They used
and more.
It in the finish, too, didn't they?
Using the nitrocellulose finish. Usually the nitrocellulose in the finishes has been pretty good. Cross your fingers, knock on wood, that will continue to be that way. There, I have seen, and this is the cautionary tale, certain instruments where the finish is obviously starting to decay, and I also have had to turn them away. Vega made some really beautiful guitars in the 1940s and 50s, and I've had several people bring me old Vegas, and the finish is cloudy. And you look at it and you clean it all up and kind of oil it up and put it on the stand, leave it there for a week, and it starts to cloud again. And I realize the finish is actually out, the whole finish is outgassing. Mm. And I've had to tell people I can't sell that guitar because I'm going to sell it to someone who's going to put it in the case. They're going to pull it out six months later, and the finish is going to have started to melt or gas off the guitar. And you'd have to strip it and refinish it, which kind of ruins the originality. So it's a no-win situation. It's either going to kill itself, or you're gonna have to kill it one way or the other. So luckily, that's most old Martins, Gibsons, Fenders, Gretsches. I'm not seeing that with. So cross your fingers. In our lifetime, they won't destroy themselves. But most of them are doing pretty well. You think that when most what we now call vintage instruments were made, they used to just be old guitars. Now they're vintage instruments, but most of them were not intended to last a lifetime. Martins were.
Yeah.
Martin expected you to play your Martin guitar for a lifetime. That was part of their deal. Gibson, not so much, depending on what it was. And a lot, like a Harmony was expected to last you 2 or 3 years, and you just buy another one. The best you can have for the money you spend. That was their slogan. So the fact that people can still enjoy these instruments, 50, 60, 70 years later, a testament to the really how well a lot of things were done. When you handle a lot of old instruments, you also become aware of all the people who cut corners and did sloppy work. And, yeah. You know, I could give you a litany of goofball things that we've found, if you want to go there. But
I want to go everywhere. So
yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm talking endlessly, but that's the idea, right?
Oh, that's the idea, okay. Man. I just...
Are you supposed to be talking too, or are you just like, you know, we got Eli sitting here and
yeah, I'm just in the background like laughing.
Oh, he's the audience then. Yeah. We have
the peanut gallery.
Yeah, we have a little audience. It's always better with some kind of an audience. Although I find
we'd just be sitting here staring at each other.
I know. I actually find as a musician, and I was never a particularly successful musician, but I toured internationally. I made some records and stuff. And I discover now that I don't really need an audience anymore. Like my relationship to music has become so personal that I can just sit, and I have a nice little deck upstairs. I can sit and just play to an empty deck and be perfectly happy. I'm just playing for myself at this point.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, but it's also kind of fulfilling in an oddball kind of way, because when you play for an audience, of course, you're hopefully trying to either please them or annoy them. I was always in the please, unless they were completely tasteless, and then the annoy phase. But, you know, it gets to the point now where I'm just kind of making music to see what it sounds like. And that's kind of fun. That's like a new thing.
Do you have a particular instrument, or you just sort of pick one up and play... anything.
I mean, segueing to me, I started musical life as an electric bass player, which was one of those really smart decisions I made as a 15-year-old, because I knew a lot of people who already played guitar decently, and they're all like, oh, man, nobody plays the bass. And this light bulb went off in my head, bing!
Yeah.
They all need a bass player. So I felt like I was several years behind a couple. I knew a really good guitar player, like 15, 16. He had a great name. His name was Clyde Spillinger, which is like right out of a 1930s gangster film. And he was a really just a talented cat and very generous with his time. And I played with him a little early on and just watched someone and went, he's already really good. I'm not going to be that good. Maybe never, but certainly not in like 6 months. But I actually really liked the sound of the electric bass. And I love Duane Eddy. And I thought because he played low notes, he was a bass guitarist. So I got an electric bass in the summer of 76. And I was in bands instantly because everyone needed a bass player. So my musical identity to this day is as an electric bassist. I'm a terrible upright bassist. I can fake it for about 5 minutes and my hand just goes, nope, stop.
Yeah.
I get down on my knees and thank Leo Fender. Thank you. Thank you, Uncle Leo. But when
you're sitting on the deck, you're not playing your bass.
I play bass sometimes. I mostly play guitar. I play a lot. I'm a excitedly mediocre guitar player, but I sort of have a style and I do what I like to do. And I play mandolin kind of badly, but if you were starting a little string band right now, I could fake it for you. I could get through the night as long as you stick to, you know, keys that are not jazz keys.
Yeah.
And I can hack out a tune on the tenor banjo if I have to. I'm terrible. Funny enough, because I'm considered the banjo guy here, I'm actually terrible on a five string, which I attribute to actually being left-handed, but I play instruments the normal, quote, right-handed way, unquote.
Yeah.
And the only one that didn't come together for me is the frailing on the five string. Somehow I couldn't, my right hand just didn't seem to want to pick up the kind of up, down, in, out, up, down. That didn't work for me somehow. So I can hack out a couple of Uncle Dave Macon tunes to the amusement of whoever I'm demonstrating the banjo for, and that's the extent of that. But I can fake anything else to the point of at least showing someone what it sounds like. You know, we have some really good musicians on staff here, you know, all of whom play different styles, and it's actually a lot of fun. We don't have enough in-store jams. That's the weird thing. Everybody here has a different... I don't even know how many people work here. 7, 8 people work here at this point. And all of them, people come in and say, oh, do you play the guitar? And it's like, well, why would they be working in a guitar store if they don't play the guitar?
Yeah.
You know, we have some you know, very contemporary players. We have some people who play real kind of vintage styles. It's sort of an interesting mix. I would describe myself as a dyed-in-the-wool vintage. I come out of vintage rock and roll, but I also got really into, like, pre-war string band music at one point because I just got tired of electricity. I felt old in my 30s. I'll announce to the crowd, I just turned 63, and I still feel 22. But, you know, when I got into my 30s, I'm like, oh, I'm playing this teenage music. You know, I should try to find some stuff you can grow old with. And I got really obsessed with 1930s, especially brother duets and stuff like that. I love songs. That's the thing that excites me, is how a song is put together, like how the verse and the chorus, how the melody and the chords relate. And I actually discovered, and you can stop me if I'm wandering off into stuff that's too personal, but I actually...
Please, go on.
But I just, I mean, everyone has a different thing that excites them about music. And I discovered what excites me is the song and the sound of the song. I don't give a crap about the notes. You know, you get players, oh, you got to know this scale and that scale. I don't know any scale. I mean, I know them, but I don't know them on purpose, you know. But what is interesting to me is when you hear a melody, how does it interact with the chords? How do those two or three notes create that, you know, there's a magical sound you can get with three notes. How does that work? So I've spent my entire life kind of figuring it out. And I almost think I don't want to get too good at it because I know players who are really, really advanced. And I think the magic goes out of it to a certain extent. And they start to get kind of analytical about it. And that's to me, that's no fun. It's not, if you're thinking about it intellectually, to me, if you're thinking about music intellectually, the fun is almost entirely gone out of it. And I see players come in here, I think, are just, you know, they're playing a million notes a minute. And I, which one of those notes did you really want? Because you used all of them. You know, I got one or two. You know, I know Neil Young is got a lot of hipster cred now, but, you know, Cinnamon Girl is a one-note guitar solo. And someone once said to him, well, Neil, why is that only one note? He goes, well, it's one note, but it's on two strings. And I mean, that's the magic of it. It's like, how is your one note different from anyone else's one note? So I've kind of spent my life trying to figure that out. But that also affects and infects my work with guitars as well, because I'm not, you know, a lot of vintage guitar stores are really big on, well, we've got 50 Les Pauls, so we've got 82 Strats. And what is our language quotient here? Can my language be salty or should it be G-rated?
You can be salty.
Okay, well, I don't like to use profanity unless it really emphasizes a point. But
excellent.
There is a school of guitars, especially vintage guitars, I like to call the big dick rock guitars.
Yeah.
And those are the ones perfect for playing the music of 1971. And it's Les Pauls and Fender Stratocasters and Gibson ES-335s. They're all beautiful instruments. I have nothing against the instruments. But the cliche of how they tend to be used to me is very time-worn and of very little interest. So partially through my influences, partially through the way things go, this shop doesn't really concentrate. You know, I have a lot of Fenders, but I don't have a lot of Gibsons. But we're not... A lot of guitar stores you walk into and they have this kind of limited palette of Sonics.
Yeah.
You know, we specifically look for the stuff that isn't that. And it doesn't mean I don't have a really nice, you know, 56 special on the wall, which is a beautiful thing. But I also have a lot of weird stuff that a lot of guitar stores will probably look at and go, oh, what's that doing here?
Can you point one out? What are you thinking of?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking I have a Knutson harp guitar sitting right here. you know, and it's actually a beautiful thing. We have a really fantastic Larson harp guitar, which to me are the best. Those are the best harp guitars ever made. And... You know, those are just things that your average big dick guitar player is not particularly interested in.
No, they wouldn't.
Everyone comes in and sees the Mando bass on the wall. You know, that's just a different thing. We got lots of lap steels, you know, Ukes mandolins, lots of oddball electrics. We really like oddball electrics. We don't deal with a lot of the really cheaper stuff from the 50s and 60s because it's hard to get them to play to our... Like, we like to have things play to a professional level, even if you're not a professional.
Yeah.
We like to have the instrument be playable. And when you're dealing with something like a Tysco that was made in 1965, they actually can sound kind of cool.
Absolutely.
But to make them play to a good pro level, you probably have to straighten the neck. You most likely have to refret or at least work on the frets. Yeah. You know, the woods were not selected for longevity, so a lot of them have warped and bent and twisted by now. And it's just kind of like, by the time we put all that work into it, unless it's a really interesting guitar, it's probably lost on the person buying it. So we kind of, it's not that we stay away from it. We actually have several staff members who really love guitars like that, but we don't find that many really nice ones that are worth, you know, putting $1,000 into. Because you're going to sell it for $1,000 when you're done.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, that's kind of the problem. So we tend to, we get some people who come in here and you know, think that everything here is too expensive, which it probably is. But it also reflects that certain amount of care and work. And I'm going to do a sideways commercial, but I've bought guitars from most of the major dealers in the U.S., and some of them are friends of mine, but I'm often appalled when something comes in. It's like, this is a $30,000 guitar, and they couldn't be bothered to take the rusty strings off and intonate the bridge and clean the crud out of the pickups and fix the frets that are falling out and, you know, mention that there's broken parts or missing things. We try not to do that. You know, we make mistakes and we miss stuff, but I consider if you're, you know, I was a big record hound.
when I was a kid. I was just obsessed with music, and that's how I got into guitars. But I used to go to, you know, you go to a place that's a collector's record store, and all the records would be in bags, and anything good was $20. But at least they found it, they bagged it, they cleaned it. You know, I'd go to a junk bookstore and pull out a copy of Piper at the Gates of Dawn. You know, I'd be, well, that's $20. That's a rare record. It's like, yeah, but you're not treating it like a rare record. You're treating it like junk. So that's kind of the way we feel about the guitars, is we treat them as objects worthy of, you know, honor. And we don't just kind of dump them around and leave them dirty and everything. And that's kind of the way I look at it. It's like if you take the care and put it into the object, whatever it is, then you can expect someone who cares about it to, you know, to give you more money to pay for that, you know. So I don't know. That's kind of a bit of a philosophy. I don't know, but well, we tell record store tales forever too. That'd be a segue.
I think of you as one of the major experts that I've ever spoken to about instruments, and I was wondering if I could ask you how you learned. What was your process of learning?
It's a lifetime. I learned something new today. I try to learn something new every day. It comes down to, and again, stop me if this gets too absurdly personal, but as a kid, I always somehow dug deeper into the things I was interested in. I got really into, I come from a weird confluence of both of my, my grandfather on my mother's side, my father were naval architects. And I got really kind of interested in naval history and in military history as a kid. And I just obsessively read books. And I got to the point, and I still could do this today, you show me the lineup of British battle cruisers at the Battle of Jutland, I can tell you what class each one is. You know, you show me a bunch of ships from the mid-30s, I can tell you, well, you see, the Pennsylvania had a conning tower one step higher than the Arizona because it was fitted out as a flagship. So I was teaching myself that as a child. And the skill of observing and analyzing, I think inadvertently I taught myself. I did it because I was interested in it. You know, what's the difference between the Exeter and the York? Well, the Exeter has stacks that are this, and the York had a bridge that was different. But then you look at what's the difference between a 62 and a 64 Stratocaster? Cool. So I trained myself from a young age with things that had nothing to do with guitars, but it's training your brain to observe and categorize and think about things and why are things this way. I was also really interested in animals and science, and at the age of six, and I'm probably talking about too much about
myself, this is great. Please.
At the age of six, like my mother's friends go, oh, what does little Peter want to be when he grows up? And I would literally go, a paleontologist.
Yeah.
And they just looked at me like, boom. But that was true. And so I taught myself to read so I could read about dinosaurs. And unfortunately, everything I learned about dinosaurs has now been proven false. So I'm no longer any kind of... At six, I was an authority on dinosaurs and apparently an authority on automobiles, which is funny because I grew up in New York. I've never actually sat behind the driver's seat of a car. But
I've never driven a car.
I've never driven a car. But if... you know, and here's a great working of fate story. So I told you my father was a naval architect. Unfortunately, he died when I was very young. But he was working on cars in our garage. I was born in New York, but I lived in New Jersey as a young child. And there were six or seven Studebakers in various stages of dissolution. Oh, cool. And I was already looking at that. And if he had lived even until I was a teenager, I would now be sitting in a garage full of vintage automobiles doing exactly what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But it would be vintage cars instead of vintage guitars because that was my first interest. And just because, you know, after he died, my mom hightailed us back to New York, and I had no access to them, so I went in other directions. But to this day, I still will pass like an old Thunderbird on the street and go, ooh, it's a 63 Thunderbird. Yeah, you know, there's a little of that, a little of it is left, but it segued into other things. And when I got into music, it was super analytical about music. Like, I would look, I don't know how, you know, how does this happen? How does your brain work? But when I listened to a record, I listened to a Beatle record as a teenager, like as a 13-year-old, I'd be like, what guitars are they playing? Mm. It was like looking at a picture of a ship going, ooh, is that the Arizona or is that in the Nevada class or Pennsylvania class? It was like literally, and I was like, ooh, Rickenbacker. What is that bass? That's a Hofner. The quest in the pre-internet era, the quest to find this out was somewhat daunting. Yeah. There were no books. There was a magazine called Guitar Player, and they had one little column called Rare Bird. And we would devour that. I could quote you some of Tom Wheeler's Rare Bird columns. I read them so many times. Some collectors confuse the reverse and non-reverse Firebirds, but to a real collector, that's like confusing Errol Flynn and Elmer Fudd. That was one of his lead lines, and it's such a great lead line. Yeah. 50 years later, I still remember it. Yeah. That's a fabulous lead line. He, you know, and he wrote a book in 1982, published a book called American Guitars. And if you'd known me as a kid, I was known as this enormous cheapskate. A, because my family, it was just me and my mom, and she was a single mom. We didn't really have much money, and I didn't get a lot of money to play stuff. And I had an aversion to working, I keep to this day, but I worked stupid little jobs. But that book came out, and it was $31.95. And I scrapped together $32, and a friend of mine who was my drummer in my band at the time had never seen me spend more than like $2. I could find a record for $2 and be very excited about it.
Yeah.
And we went to this bookstore. We walked to this bookstore it was a Broadway and 82nd Street. And I walked in and I plunked down $31.95 for this book. And he's like, "You bought a $30 book on guitars?" It was alien to him.
Yeah.
That anyone would do that, but especially that I would do that because I wouldn't buy a candy bar. But I'm like, no, it was like a tome. It was like I had just bought the Rosetta Stone. I had bought something that would allow me to learn more about this. And it's, you know, it's a lifetime thing.
Well, wasn't that something?
Oh, my God. Incredible.
And that's only half. We have a whole other half to that interview.
And that'll be in our third episode,
yes,
right?
Our third episode, which should come out almost on top of this one, because we'll do them together. No, that was really, that's a piece of history there.
Amazing.
Listening to Peter, I think that was a really great thing. What a fascinating person.
And so inspiring. It makes me want to sort of go home and just learn about everything I possibly can.
Yes. That's a really good point. So we got a couple more things in this episode. What do we got next?
Well, are we going to listen to Pat's recording now? We have... you know, a little backstory. Jeff and I spent a while selecting this song because this whole album is absolutely incredible, and maybe Jeff will tell us a little bit more about it. But this tune is called Ain't a Bit Drunk. Pat Conti recorded it with Don Fierro. It's our very first Jalopy record, recorded over a decade ago.
And yeah, it doesn't seem like that long. But, oh, it's so good.
It's so good.
So good.
Wow.
I asked, that started out as I asked Pat to make a fiddle and banjo record. And he said, "Oh, Jeff, I'm a guitar player." I said, "No, man, I have heard you play banjo and fiddle." He's an incredible fiddle player. And it's sort of just in his, it's as Peter was talking about, he plays his way. And he really takes these songs and makes them absolutely his. And I'm so proud of this record. It was amazing to hear him play these things. And I think we should probably just get to listening to it.
I'm ready.
All right.
Yeah. water from a yellow girl and I'm not a man. I mean just what I say.
Here we are. We've come to the end of our second episode.
We're wrapping up our second episode.
I think this was great. It was this interview with Peter was better than I could have imagined.
It was so fun to be there in the room for it. I could listen to him talk forever.
And in that room, we're just in a room of such all of those instruments, just hundreds of gorgeous instruments.
Like a museum. I think he says this, but it feels just like a museum, but somehow you're allowed to touch the incredible art in the museum.
Yeah, exactly.
How lucky.
That's so cool.
And it's right down the street from us.
Yeah. I hardly ever go there, but it is just right down the street. Well, here we are. We're finishing up, and here is a song, a Woody Guthrie song by Mr. Wyndham Baird.
Sweetheart and my parents, I left in my old hometown. I'm out to do the best I can. I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around. My mother prayed that I would be a man of some renown, but I'm just a refugee as I go rambling around, boy, as I go rambling around. They're loaded, limbs are bending down, and I pick them all day for a dollar, boys. I go rambling around, boys. I go rambling around. Sometimes the fruit gets rotten, falls down on the ground. There's a hungry mouth for every peach. I go rambling around. I wish that I could marry, wish I could settle down, but I can't save a penny. Boys, as I go rambling around, boys, as I go rambling around.
Well, folks, that's the end of the Jalopy Corndog Hour with Natalie Jordan and Jeff Wood. Can't thank you enough for listening. So from all of us at the Jalopy Theater and School of Music, if you're not out there loving each other, you best get to it. So long.